You're listening to Bob, Dave, and More on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
The 5 o'clock refresh is brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, made to chill. Well, we should be getting ready for opening day. We'd be just days away from this happening out there at T-Mobile Park, but we know what's happening out there in society. And we were looking forward to speaking to this man every week about what was going on in the world of baseball. You see him on MLB Network. He is with us on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. He is John Paul Morosi. John, how are you, man?
Bob, Dave, Jim, great to be with you guys tonight, and really I'm honored to just help keep the baseball conversation going and keep the conversation going in general. You guys are doing a great job just being on the air tonight, and thanks for having me be part of the show. And certainly, Jim, it's been a while, my friend. It was great to see you out there a couple years back, and certainly it was 15 years ago, my friend, that I was a summer intern there at the PI. It's amazing how fast time goes, but it's great to be back with you on the air.
Yeah, it's great to hear your voice too, John Paul. I sure enjoyed working with you, and I'm sure glad that you didn't take my advice outside of Safeco Field that one day, because look at you now, man. Every time I turn on the TV, there you are. You're a superstar, and I was telling you at the time, you need to stay at the PI. You really need to stay at the PI, and you chose not to do that. You went to the Detroit Free Press, back to your hometown, and boy, now you're a national celebrity.
Well, I appreciate, Jim, all the friendship and all the advice over the years, and I did listen to your advice very, very seriously and consider it. And to be honest, one of the big arcs, I guess, that I'll share, that is certainly one of the big reasons why I ended up going back to my hometown, is that my then girlfriend, now wife, got into medical school at Michigan, and so we collectively, both being from Michigan, wanted to come back. So that was really as much as of a reason as there was anything else, was just the personal side of things. And so here we are all these years later, and as you mentioned very kindly and too generous on my TV work. But right now, like a lot of people, I'm still working as much as I can, but my main job is raising our three girls as we wait for baseball to come back, and my wife, of course, she always is the most important and most smartest person in the family, but now, of course, she's working as a doctor during these very difficult times. So it's up to me to support her as we all are supporting each other. And so, Jim, I appreciate it. But certainly this week of all weeks, I look around and I say sports are very important. But when I say goodbye to my wife every morning, it's certainly a much higher level of importance in what she's doing right now.
Yeah, we see how important it is, John, with, you know, a lot of people texting in just glad to have a diversion, right? Just something that's not beating them over the head with the virus, and here's what's going on, and even though sports are being impacted by it. So you're obviously a big part of that. And I'm just curious, as it pertains to the game of baseball, and we you know, read about what they may do, when it may start, how they would, you know, handle the season. Is there a cutoff date in your mind where you say, you know what, they can't feasibly put together a season if this whole thing extends past whatever date, May, June, whatever? What is there a cutoff date in your mind where the season may become a wash?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that it's probably around the middle, and I like July area. I think if we're playing games at the major league level, non-spring training by June, I think that gives us plenty of time to have a meaningful regular season and then a playoff. And then if it's in July, there's probably still some ways to do it. But to me, it feels like you would at least want to hit that 80-game mark where it's at least roughly half of the year where you could feel good about it. I certainly think one of the aspects, and my colleague at MLB Network, Joel Sherman, has talked about this, among all the unknowns that we've got right now in our lives, we don't know if there will be a seasonality to this, if there is the possibility of the virus becoming an issue again in the fall, late fall, whenever that would be. And so I do think MLB will be somewhat wary to schedule things too far deep into November. I think that to me would feel like MLB is going to be somewhat cautious of that, especially because we are coming up next year, a year from right now, in fact, will be the World Baseball Classic, which means a great deal to MLB. Again, of course, health permitting, think about a year from now, they'll be playing the World Baseball Classic, which has come to be a major event on the MLB calendar and the World Baseball calendar. So I do think MLB would be wary of shortening the offseason too much, knowing that in 2021 we're probably going to be seeing some earlier reporting dates because of the time needed to prepare for the World Baseball Classic. So I do think that I'm going to be optimistic. I think we're going to have baseball this year. My hope is June at the latest, and that seems to be about where people are pegging this right now. We know, of course, it's not going to be before the middle of May based on the most recent guidance from the CDC on crowd sizes. So I think that, to me, if we're started by May, wonderful. If it's June, I think it's also a very acceptable result. If it ends up being July, I think that's probably getting where maybe the league starts to reconsider just what the schedule looks like. But I think in general, guys, I'm going to be very optimistic here and say we're going to have baseball this year is my prediction and my strong feeling. And let's hope that it's, if not before, then let's hope it's by June.
Well, that's good to hear, John, and I hope you're right. But, you know, I mean, I know we kind of undersell the logistics of, you know, getting it done and getting these things scheduled. So you think if they do start, they'll just, you know, play half, whatever. I heard one story about possibly playing doubleheaders to kind of make it up. What is it going to look like that? And do you think that they can move quickly if there's suddenly an all-clear sign, or is it just the logistics are too daunting to get that done?
I think that this, and it's a great question, just about the ramp up of how the season goes and the nature of pitching. I saw the Jerry DePoto's comments today about how the Mariners are effectively now back into off season mode. It's going to take a while. I think pitchers are going to have to. The idea is not that everybody has to go home and stay ready and stay in mid season game shape. I think the message, appropriately so, and certainly in Seattle and other places around the country, is go home and be a good citizen first and foremost, and keep our social distance as we're required to do right now, and understand that it's going to take some time to ramp things back up. I mean, I think the sport is in idle right now, and that's really where it should be if we're all going to do our part as citizens to come together and adhere to a lot of these protocols. So I think because of that, it's going to take some time on the front end to get ready again, which is why I think June, even if we're kind of back into our normal social routines and work routines by May, which I hope is realistic, that it's going to take a few weeks to get ready for baseball, and that's only normal. The big question, I think, that when you consider if it's in June and you think about, okay, are we going to have 100 games, will it be 90 games, whatever it might be in that range by then, is what the league does about interleague play. And how the schedule is rebalanced at that point in time, because one of the competitive issues there is the one thing that in this divisional format that all teams compete for are the wild cards. And so if you have a drastically different number of games that you're playing in the division versus the interleague play, it creates some inequity in competition, which admittedly right now is the least of our concerns. But I do think that it's going to call to mind, do we have to have interleague play? What is the fairest way to do this? I do think that with doubleheaders, to me, that's a little too risky. And one of the reasons why it's a little too risky, in my own very amateur layman's understanding of the situation here, is that if God forbid, we start the season and there's a flare-up of the virus again in one particular area, one particular city, that would make it hard for one team to play in a particular venue for a week or 10 days, whatever it may be. Then if that team's playing a bunch of doubleheaders, then the logistics become really difficult. So I think that just to help build in some padding here and there with the schedule, just because we really don't know enough right now about where we're all headed with the situation, I think doubleheaders to me seem risky. The union may well say they don't want to go that way anyway. So I think that it's going to have to be what would appear to be a relatively, from a scheduling workload standpoint, a not too overbearing lift on everybody to do it. And I think one other part about the in-division aspect of things is travel. We're at a time when travel itself becomes a bit of a logistical and mental hurdle almost, I think, for people here as we're considering where we're at. Keeping teams somewhat closer to home in regional traveling arrangements most of the time. Of course, obviously, we have out-of-division games, which are inevitable in baseball. But staying somewhat closer to home and playing a lot of your games in division, to me right now, doesn't seem like that bad of an idea. I think it actually we may see more games taking place in your division as a percentage than we do normally, and I think right now that's probably the best way to do things.
Hey, John Paul, before everything shut down, there was a lot of excitement here in Seattle building for Jared Julio Rodriguez, and Kelnick maybe was going to be with the major league team sometime this season, possibly in September. Rodriguez probably a year or two away, perhaps. But what are you hearing nationally about these two prospects for the Mariners?
Well, incredibly impressive, both of them. And I've had a chance to speak with Jared directly. I've not spoken to Julio in the past, but I know certainly his reports are outstanding. Jared, I talked to him before he was drafted, and I got to tell you, Jim, and we've seen this really get borne out in the way that he's played. He is one of the most confident 18-year-olds that I ever talked with in my life in any sport, any venue. Just totally sure of who he is. And the fact that you think about his road, never played high school baseball because of the fact that his high school season didn't start until the summer in Wisconsin. So he's very much a self-made player. And he carries with him an incredible level of belief along with that. And it says a lot that when Team USA picked their under-18 national team, he was basically at that point in time, a high school sophomore. So he was a year younger than most players. And he still made the team, even coming from Wisconsin, which I know for him and his family was a tremendous badge of honor. I mean, he's very proud of where he's from. And I think that just with him, you're getting someone who is really, I think he's got a good chip on his shoulder from that standpoint of being from the Midwest. And his self-belief, it's not as overt and as popularized and as marketed in a Bryce Harper way, but his conviction in himself, I think, is Harper-like. And I mean that in a very good way. He has got, there's a lot of different thoughts about, okay, what is great makeup? What do you want to see in a young player? He has got great competitive makeup. I would say that he would never say this, you know, on the record, because I'm sure he wouldn't want to have like these words next to his name, but I'm sure that every time he steps on the field, he believes that he is as talented and as good as anybody else. And I think that is what the great young players that have been around all believe in themselves. I think about Justin Verlander, his rookie year. That's how Justin was. That's how Felix was when he came up. I don't know what his career pathway is going to be. I really don't, Jim, but to me, he has the intangible qualities and the work ethic and the pride and the drive that you see with great players. And if I'm a Mariner fan, I am thrilled every day that he's in the organization, because that was a phenomenal trade they made for a really impressive and driven young man.
John Paul Morosi is our guest here with Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle. And John, just overall, what's your take on what Jerry's done? I mean, this is—it's both promising, just with the guys you're talking about, but it can be frustrating. I mean, it's been almost two decades since this team has found the postseason, so the fan base, to a certain extent, is frustrated with a teardown. And when we were talking about this season, and when Jerry and Scott Service talked about this season, more importantly, they were very clear. Hey, it's not about winning this year. It's about developing the youth. I mean, you know, you tell a fan base that you're not really expecting to win much, it can be a tough pill to swallow for one that hasn't seen the postseason. So do you look at that and say, you know what, it's going to be worth it in the end, it's absolutely the right thing to do, or do you feel like they should have taken a different approach to this?
Well, I think that if you look at it overall, and it's a really great question and a great insight into where they're at, the way that the season finished 2 years ago when they faded down the stretch and we thought for all the world they were headed to the playoffs and it didn't work out, it would have been very hard for the Mariners to look at themselves at that point in time and say, hey, we're going to be better than Houston in 2019. And I think that was the right call. Now, to your point, they're not going to be able to win right now in 2020, win the division probably, and make the playoffs. But given the dynamics of the division as it existed when they made that decision, it was the right call. Because you have to calculate, if you're not going to be the Yankees or the Red Sox in many cases, a team like Houston, the Dodgers, that can just spend and really have a fully functioning great star level MLB team and a great player development system all the time that with all these resources, I think they made the right call to say, listen, we're just simply not going to be as good as Houston in the next couple of years. But let's try to find a way to cycle up whenever they kind of cycle down. And that, to me, is basically what could happen. Houston, they still have a chance to have a good year this year. Who knows? It's like uncertainty upon uncertainty with where we're at right now with the game and in our lives and in the sport. But to me, the AL West, in large part, I would expect Oakland, as we speak right now, has as much of a chance to win the division as Houston does. It just feels that way to me. Oakland's a really good team, and Houston has Verlander just had surgery. Greinke's getting older. McCullers is coming off surgery. There's a lot of uncertainty there on top of what they've had with the sign stealing. So, to me, the Mariners' time and their window probably starts in 2021. Kelnick should be on the team for the full season that year, I believe. Maybe Rodriguez comes up. We see what happens with Gilbert. Evan White, of course, will be well into hopefully his comfort level as a first baseman. That's your window. And I think I've got no problem with when you make a realistic assessment of this team at the end of 2018, they were not better than the Astros. They just simply weren't. And so they made the right call at that point in time. Before then, did they make some mistakes? Sure, I think every team does, but they certainly made their mistakes. But I think in general, they made the right call to go with this youth movement. And I think overall, if I'm a Mariner fan, I see Kelnick, I see Dunn, Gilbert and White and Rodriguez is coming. It's a good group that I'm excited about, that I think that their window, 21, 22, 23, I would feel really good about those 3 years there for the Seattle Mariners.
John Paul, when and if the baseball season gets going again, you mentioned the Houston Astros. Does all of the disdain for them, all the hatred and the heckling and everything, is that going to come right back, or is that going to actually sort of mute that for them for a little while? Or what do you see that looking like?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because really their situation was top of mind for everybody for a very long time, and then I haven't given it much of a thought the last 3 or 4 days or so. That's for sure. You're just thinking about other stuff, and I think that's what we should be thinking about right now, of course. But I mean, to me, the Astros, when the games begin again, I think probably fans will want to do what fans feel most natural in doing, and in spring training, that was booing the Houston Astros. I assume that will happen for at least every time they go to a new stadium, a new ballpark. During the course of the season, they'll probably get booed again. And really, to your point, when you mention Houston Astros, right now you think great team, but there's a cloud. And that cloud is not going to go away anytime soon. That cloud is still going to be there whenever they play their next games. And to me, it's going to be a very difficult mental lift for them during the course of the season to just handle that on a day-by-day basis. We're all, I think, reckoning with a very unique mental space right now as Americans, and I think that they have that on top of everything else that they've been dealing with this spring. So it's going to be a difficult season for them. Maybe they would have wanted to just get right into it. I'm sure they probably did, and attack this thing head on, but obviously that's not reality right now. So I still think there's going to be a fair level of antipathy waiting for them whenever the games begin. And it's going to be one of the reasons why I really like Oakland's chances to win the division this year. Why I think Texas, with their rotation, it's kind of under the radar. It's a really, really good rotation. And I believe they've got a chance to be pretty competitive this year. So, and the Angels, they'll have a really, really good lineup. It's going to, I think, not going to be good enough, their pitching, to win the division. But that lineup with the Angels will be good enough to scare a lot of teams and win a lot of baseball games. So it's going to be a tough ride for the Astros this season. And again, if I had to pick the AL West champ today, it's going to be Oakland over what I expect is going to be a very, very beleaguered Houston team by the end of the year.
Hey, John, I love baseball, always have, always will, no matter what they do, whatever the rule changes are and the different things that are going on. But what about the younger crowd? What would you do to make baseball more appealing? Because ratings are down, crowds are down. I'm concerned about the long-term welfare.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very fair point, Jim. I mean, I think about it a lot. I mean, obviously, I love the game. I'm around it every day, and it's a big part of my life. And so I think about a lot of those same topics of how we can make the game better. There's going to have to be a bit of a generational shift. I would like to see that happen, and I think a lot of the old guard thought processes about not flipping your bat and not showing emotion, it really works against the growth of the game. When you think about it, if you were to watch video, and I was in Japan in November for the Premier 12 in the Olympic qualifying tournament, and the fans there are so great. There is no walk-up music there, Jim, because, as you know, all the fans there have their own songs that they choreograph and sing. It's as though you've got the Cameron Crazies projected over a 55,000-seat baseball stadium that's loud the whole game. And it's funny. The whole time I was there, no one talked about pace of play. No one talked about not flipping your bat in terms of rules or respect. It's just it's a beautiful spectacle. And I really believe that if we alter our own perspective, and by our, I mean the American baseball folks, if we kind of change our perspective a little bit and realize just how much passion and excitement there is in the game around the world, and maybe borrow a little bit of what we see there, we're going to be just fine. Because the game itself is so exciting, it is so passionate, and when you really dial it in and let the players be themselves, the bat flips that you see all throughout Latin America and Korea, it's such a beautiful expression of joy in the game. And there is simply no reason that we cannot have that for ourselves except for ourselves. We just have to change our perspective on that. And I think MLB has done a very good job of marketing, let the kids play and let the players be themselves. But ultimately, that's also up to the players. And the notion of retribution for flipping a bat ends up you have to get thrown at. It's so regressive, it doesn't make sense to me. So I hope that we change that way of doing things and allow the players to be themselves and market themselves in a really productive way. Although I will say this on their behalf, one of the biggest challenges that we've got as a sport is the number of games that we play. It's also one of our biggest attributes, but the number of games is tough. It's tough to tell a fan in Kansas City or Detroit, hey, listen, follow your own team, but then at 10 o'clock every night, turn on Mike Trout's game to watch Mike Trout, or turn on the Mariner game to watch Jared Kelnick in a year's time. It's just hard to be that invested in other teams and other players and talk about them in the way that we all in this country, we know Tom Brady, we know his story. But we do that because the Patriots, or now the Buccaneers, play one game a week and everybody gets a chance to watch him. It's just different in baseball. And so I think structurally we've got some challenges there. But I think overall, there's enough of a foundation to really work well for the future if the players and the fans and the media and the executives, if we all realize just how good we've got it and find a way to present just this the beautiful majesty of baseball in its own way, but with a lot of flair that I think makes it a more contemporary game for 2020.
You see him on MLB Network. He is John Paul Morosi. He's been our guest here with Bob, Dave, and more. John, really good to talk to you, man. Hopefully we're getting a chance to talk more frequently because that'll mean this whole thing has subsided and we've got baseball to discuss. So really looking forward to that happening. Thanks so much for taking time with us, man.
My pleasure, gentlemen, and thanks to Mora as well for having me on the show tonight. And just it just means a lot to be able to be talking with you guys. I love Seattle so much for my time living there and have family there now. So just stay safe and just know that we're thinking of you there. I've been thinking about Seattle every day. So you guys are on my thoughts, and look forward to many, many baseball conversations here during the course of the year.
Thanks so much. There he is, John Paul Morosi. MLB Network. Good to talk to him. Hey, coming up, timing is everything when it comes to getting a big NFL contract. And Dave Wyman did the research on some guys that have benefited from that really, really good timing. We're going to talk about that next. It is Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
It is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle. Timing is everything, right, Dave Wyman? You went back and did some research. You're on lockdown at your home, so you just started breaking down game tape. You started looking at different contracts. You got into all kinds of different things. But before we get into the game tape you broke down, we'll get into that in the next segment. I want to get your thoughts on some of these guys where timing has worked against them, and some of them timing has really, really paid off for them.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and I enlisted Son of Augustuson, Brandon, at 710sports.com, and, you know, just said, hey, 710sports.com, can you look up, you know, some of these other, you know, just kind of got the ball rolling, and he did a good job of coming up with some some names, but I think the one that stood out to me the most was, and this is me complaining as an old linebacker, but Nick Kwiatkowski, who just signed with the Las Vegas Raiders, still have a hard time with that one. But yeah. He's the king of good timing to me in this offseason because he was a backup. And, you know, he was, what was he, like a, he was a fourth-round draft choice out of West Virginia for Chicago, appeared in 57 games and started in 22 games. So, you know, less than half of the games did he start, but he started 8 games last year for Danny Trevathan. And he had a good year. In 8 starts, he got 3 sacks. He had an interception, which was his only one in his career. And then he had 76 tackles, which projects out to be, you know, over 150, which would have put him second or third in the NFL. So he just signed a 3-year deal for $21 million. So, I mean, as a backup and a fourth rounder, you put 4 years in and he had the right year, the right season at the right time going into the end of his contract. He cashed in on it. But it also got me thinking about guys on the other side and two right here in Seattle. And we talked to Clayton about this earlier, Jaron Reed being one of them. I mean, and I kind of laid out the scenario. What if he'd had it, if his season had gone, or his career like this, where rookie year, 1.5 sacks, second year, 1.5 sacks, his third year, 2.5 sacks, and then this last year he got 10.5 sacks with 50 tackles in his fourth year, he would have been looking at a lot bigger payday, I think. You know, and I think Clayton said 13 or 14 maybe. I mean, he got what, 11.5? But I mean, just the timing of you know, when he got that production would have paid off for him. And it's been, again, it's been good for the Seahawks. And then, you know, you look at Clowney too. Clowney actually had a 9 and a 9.5 sack seasons back-to-back in 17 and 18. What if he'd have had 9.5 last year? I feel like he might have gone in that, you know, in that first tier of signings in the free agent frenzy that's been going on. So, yeah, it's good for the Seahawks again for him too. But, you know, it's just the timing part of it is, you know, sometimes it's luck or it's just, you know, how long your contract is that you get paid these big paydays.
Well, yeah, and son of a Gustafson, he did a good job coming up with a lot of different names, and the one that stands out the most along the same lines as Jaron Reed is Shaq Barrett. When you look at the opposite of what happened there, when you said with Reed, if he'd had the 10.5 sacks this year, what kind of payday he'd be looking at. Shaq Barrett out of Tampa Bay, I'd never really heard of him, and then come to find out he's from Colorado State. He's never had more than 5.5 sacks in a season. But then this year, he gets 19.5 sacks out of nowhere. And so he gets the franchise tag, and he's making $17 million, and Tampa's working on an extension for him. So you're right about timing, Dave.
Well, what about our old buddy Jimmy Graham getting some – and I'm not sure how this timing works out for him, but it did work out because he didn't do much of anything at all in Green Bay, and I'm not one of those Jimmy Graham haters. I thought he actually played much better in Seattle than people gave him credit for. He bounced back from an incredibly serious knee injury and was really productive with it. But he didn't do much of anything with the Green Bay Packers. And he signs a pretty substantial deal with the Bears, 2 years, $16 million. Not what he was making before, but considering what he's produced, how did that work out?
Yeah. Well, you know, and then, you know, he went to Green Bay and didn't really have the production there either. So, yeah, you know, some other names, and we talked about this at the start of the show. The guy's name was Paul Kruger and played for Baltimore. And he signed a big deal in Cleveland after that. And he had some production, definitely, in Cleveland. But the last year of his contract, he got 9 sacks in the regular season against with Baltimore. And then they went to the playoffs, and he got 4.5 sacks, including 2 in the Super Bowl. So, you know, Cleveland paid him a huge payday. And, you know, you look at the rest of his career, and it's kind of up and down. But, man, getting that done at the right time is just key. And, you know, like I said, sometimes you're just lucky, you know, if you have a good year at the right time. Son of a Gustafson put it's Gustafson, not Gustafson. Son of a Gustafson put Ryan Tannehill in here. And, you know, I kind of categorize him as a guy that worked really hard and went through a lot of stuff and then worked his way into this contract because, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily put him in that he got lucky. I mean, he kind of struggled down in Tampa Bay. He's a first-round draft choice, and he had a really good year, you know, for Tennessee, and he only played in what, 9 games, Bob? I think 9 or 10.
I think 10 games.
Yeah, and you know, he was comeback player of the year, but again, good job for him. And then Eric Armstead down in San Francisco, we talked about him because he's one of those kind of like Jaron Reed, where he had a few sacks here and there, and then all of a sudden had 10 sacks, and that got him a big payday as well.
Well, yeah, you look at Tannehill and the season that he had taken over for Mariota there in Tennessee, and I'm happy for him. I mean, he made the most of his opportunity, and it's really hard. I mean, what were they going to do? They were either going to franchise tag him or perhaps lose him, and you didn't really want to lose him if you're a Titans fan, especially when your team, Ryan Tannehill, and you can talk about Derrick Henry. I know that he was a better player than Tannehill, but still, Tannehill was the quarterback of a team that made it to the AFC Championship game. So you couldn't really move on from him, but again, another case of good timing.
You're also betting that he's going to be that guy moving forward, though. Tannehill, to me, just absolutely capitalized. I think it was 12 games, actually. But still, the best 12-game stretch of his entire career up until this point. He's got a fairly substantial body of work where you look at it and go, yeah, I mean, he's had moments. He's not brutal. He's not terrible, but he's not great. He's been just kind of a mediocre player. And then in this 12-game stretch, he was a different player. Now, that's the bet they just made, that he's going to be that guy, that 12-game guy moving forward with that kind of financial commitment. We'll see if he is. I mean, it's just you've seen other teams bet on quarterbacks that get hot for a stretch. I mean, you just saw it in Jacksonville, and they just traded away the guy for a fourth-round pick after committing to Nick Foles, who's who's been hot in the past. Then he's been cold. He gets hot. He's been cold. They've made bets on quarterbacks that have that good stretch, and oftentimes it hasn't worked out, and we'll see if it works out with Tannehill.
Yeah, we'll see if that's the right guy for the job there, because you know they really like him, and making this bet seems to indicate that they like him as a leader. And another guy I'm really happy for, just because I thought Teddy Bridgewater, when the Seahawks played him in 2016, was watching him going into that game going, man, this guy, he is really on his way to be, I thought his progression kind of looked like Russell Wilson's. And then he had that just awful, awful knee injury that happened. It was a freak deal that happened in practice. Had like a compound dislocation, which is just so bad. And, you know, he started 5 games last year, and you know, and he's been the best and the highest paid backup in the league, but he just got a 3-year deal for $63 million with Carolina, so good for him.
All right, coming up, the Seahawks have made some acquisitions when it comes to the offensive line. Names you're not that familiar with, but Dave Wyman did more homework. He did some film work on these guys. He'll give you his thoughts on that. We'll come back with that. It is Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Bob Stelton, Dave Wyman, and Jim Moore.
A reminder, you can listen to our show via the 710 Sports app. It's powered by Dubin Law Group. It is free. It's available right now. It's very convenient, and it's perfect for what is happening these days out here in our society. You can just have us wherever you go, wherever you may be hunkering down these days. Meanwhile, some acquisitions made by this team in as far as the offensive line goes, not household names by any stretch of the imagination. And Dave, you did some video research on some of the new acquisitions. What'd you come away with? Were you blown away? Were you dazzled?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but you know, look, I'm not trying to be a scout or anything like that. And by the way, I know that the NFL is now offering free the NFL Rewind. That's what I log into, and I think that's what they're talking about, that they're going to offer free access to that, so you can go on and watch any game. So, and for people that want to watch, you know, go to if you go and look at I think Pro Football. Let's see, which one is it? It's Pro Football Statistics. And if you can punch in anybody's name, and you know, you could even punch my name in there, and it'll come up with stats. And you know, so it's got like pretty much for the history of, you know, the NFL, it has pretty much every player in there as far as I can tell. And, you know, what you can look and look at game logs and see, you know, which games they played in, how many snaps they played in. And for Brandon Schell, there was a lot. And for Finney, there wasn't a lot. He played in two or three games, but in last year, and he's kind of been a backup guy. And you know, we talked to the guy Fittipaldo in Pittsburgh, and we'll get a chance, by the way, tomorrow to talk to Keith Butler, who is a great Seahawk, and Bobby Wagner just passed his tackling record. He's a linebacker here, my mentor, and he's the D coordinator in Pittsburgh, and he can talk about Finney a little bit and what he sees in him. But, you know, I watched a couple of games of Finney. I watched some of the Brandon Schell and just the things that I liked with Finney. He was playing center in the Cincinnati game that I looked at, and I know that Fittipaldo's told us that he's a better guard. But he played center, and he was, you know, under center snaps, shotgun snaps, and he looks like a smart player. He does a really good job of picking up stunts, you know, when you see that. And you remember in the Pittsburgh game, the second game of the year, where, you know, you saw Fluke not pick up that stunt where one guy goes outside, the other guy comes inside, and he didn't pick it up, and Russell gets killed. So, I mean, you have to be aware of those kinds of things, and he did a really good job with that. He looks like a big, strong guy. And then I saw him getting out on screens, and looks like he's pretty mobile for a big guy, you know. And so, yeah, he looked pretty good. And I see what the Seahawks saw in him. But, I mean, watching him play center made me think, okay, I think they're bringing him in here to play center. I mean, he looks really good there. So, but, I mean, he still could play left guard, of course, because of, you know, Yapati possibly not being healthy or them re-signing him here.
So does this make you think that Britt is gone and Ifedi are both gone?
Yeah, you know, and especially watching Schell, because, you know, he's starting a lot of games. I mean, he started 15 games last year, 14 the year before that, 12, and then 8 his rookie year. So, and actually they had him listed here as a tight end at one point, but he was probably a move guy. Like Fant was, and then also it looks like he's played a little bit of guard, but it's a pretty good tackle. I mean, the game I watched, I know the Cincinnati Bengals have two good pass rushers, that Sam Hubbard, I think his name's Sam, and then Carlos Dunlap, and those two guys had three sacks, and I saw him get, Brandon Schell got a gave up a sack. But it was probably because Sam Darnold was standing there like a moron and should have moved out of the pocket, but... But, yeah, what I see out of Brandon Schell, the one thing, he's got good feet, but, man, he's got great hands. I mean, he's super explosive with his punch, and then it's quickness, you know. It's like, and the thing is, D linemen, when they're rushing you, they want to get their hands on your hands. They want to knock your hands down, and if you know, punch a guy and leave it there, you know, then that's going to happen to you. That's what Unique Ngakoue does so well. He does a great job of knocking guys' hands down off of him. And so, but, you know, if you don't leave him there, if you just continually punch, kind of like you would do in karate, Bob, you know, or just quick punches. I'm joking.
I wouldn't know anything about karate. I don't know.
It's jujitsu. I know it's jujitsu. He's got great hands, and he's a big guy, really strong guy. He's 325 pounds. And so, I mean, when I'm watching him, do I see a huge, like, improvement from Ifedi? No, not really. But, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell when you're just looking at two or three games. And like I said, I thought Ifedi was good last year. I didn't think he was great. But I didn't think that he deserved a lot of criticism. I mean, you can look at the sack numbers with Russell Wilson. But and for these guys coming in here, that's going to be something, you know, that they're going to have to get used to as well. When you're blocking for Sam Darnold, or you're blocking for you know, Roethlisberger, I mean, you know where those guys are going to be. I mean, you're backs to them, but you know they're not going anywhere. They can't run, and so for Russell, it's a huge challenge for offensive linemen. I don't think we talk about enough that, you know, you have to know where that guy is, and with Russ, you never know where he's going to go. I mean, look at that ridiculous throw that he made against the Rams. I mean, he was scrambling, running back and forth. I mean, I'm sure a lot of those offensive linemen, there's been times they've thought, hey, just hold still, man. Can you just stay in one place? But, you know, Russ makes great plays, but it's a challenge. So I think that they, you know, when they get guys like this, they got to find guys with good feet that can move.
How surprised are you that we haven't heard anything at all, at least I haven't, I don't know if you have, about a team showing interest in Jermaine Ifedi? Because
I agree with you. Listen, nobody was harder on Ifedi than I was. I don't think he's great. I don't think he's the worst either. He's durable. He's a guy who's in there week in, week out, and I still believe a coach will look at him and go, man, I can turn that guy into something. I'm actually pretty surprised we have not heard a team attached to him yet.
Yeah, well, it's just weird that, I mean, I think more strange than that is the fact that George Fant got signed to a $30 million deal for $10 million. I don't know what, you know, maybe we'll be surprised. Maybe it'll be one of those second-tier signings. Maybe next week somebody will pick up Jermaine Ifedi and pay him, you know, $12, $13 million. I don't know. I don't know what it'll be, but it's just very curious that George Fant went before Jermaine Ifedi.
Wow. Well, we'll talk more about what's going on in free agency in the world of the NFL with the professor, John Clayton. He'll join us next. It's Bob, Dave, and Moore on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Wow, you sure know a lot of stuff.
It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
We definitely did some learning today, our first foray into broadcasting from our homes, and I think it went off pretty well, and I'm guessing we learned some things as well, right, Maura?
We're still learning. We're in progress.
Okay. Well, what did we learn today?
We learned that Jim thinks Dave may be able to take Chris Sale now.
That long-held belief that Chris Sale could take you out, Dave. With the Tommy John surgery, I've changed my mind a little bit. I think if you got in the ring with Chris Sale right now, that you might have your way with him.
What if I also had Tommy John surgery?
Oh, if both of you had Tommy John surgery at the same time, I still would give Sale the edge then, because I think that would balance things out, and he's got a considerable reach advantage on you.
I love that. The Jim thinks the reach advantage is the whole thing. If he doesn't know how to use it, Jim, it really plays no part.
Well, the reason I think that he might have an advantage is he's just tall and lanky, and he just strikes me as being a guy that'd be really good with the jab, and he doesn't have much of a knockout punch. And I think that he'd win probably not a unanimous decision, but it'd be a split decision, and it'd be because of effective use of that jab that he has.
Does he look like a guy that can jab, Bob?
No, not really. He looks like a guy that you could just take him down and pound him into submission.
Yeah.
you would tackle him, Dave. You wouldn't try to stay on the outside of his reach. You'd get inside, bring him to the ground, and then the fight's over.
Yeah, and I would also have the advantage that he doesn't know who I am. He doesn't know anything about me, whereas I know about him, and I really don't like him. So I have the hatred edge. So
You've got the edge of hatred.
Don't like him because of the what? You don't like him because he cut up the uniforms, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the only thing I'm going on. I don't know him at all. I remember I said he was a punk.
I'm loving this
Jerry
delay.
DePoto kind of winced at that one when I called him a punk. But yeah.
Yeah, it's all right.
Anyway,
that's all right. What else did we learn, Maura?
Well, we learned that Jim was a little bit distracted during the professor segment.
Hey, John, what's the market going to be for Clay Matthews? Since I would imagine there'd be a fair amount of interest in him, no?
Yeah, you would think so.
Hey, John, what about Clay Matthews? He was also released by the Rams today. You think he has much left in the tank?
Attaboy, Jim.
You know,
brilliant
say something
job
about
of cutting
that.
Those.
Yes.
He forgot.
I want to say something about that. Okay, here goes. Clayton has more class than Bob and Dave. Because Clayton handled that question like he'd been asked it for the first time, and he gave an answer. And in his defense, there could have been a listener that came in a minute or two after Bob asked the Clay Matthews question. So those listeners that didn't hear the first Clay Matthews question probably appreciated the second Clay Matthews question. And that's my excuse for, you know, taking a video of my dog while the professor's segment was going on.
We're Bob and Dave being bad teammates.
How innocent Jim is in this when we were doing the snow thing and we were trying to record it and I was looking at stuff and I was trying to run the show and I asked Clayton like three of the same questions that Jim had just asked him, and he was, you know, in uproarious laughter, and shaking his head at me, and that's when I threatened him and said, "Would you like to run the show, numbnuts?" And yeah, that ended the laughing spree real quick. So, and then now he's I'm such an innocent victim on this. Yeah, that's how it goes.
And he's Bob
and
Laura. He's videotaping his dog.
It was very cute.
I screwed up. I've been working with this clown,
Dave,
for like 9 years.
Dave, we're 5 minutes from having a drink.
Okay. Oh, sorry. We're negative 15 for me.
Yeah. I think we've learned that Jim's going to be Jim's going to have a hard time focusing at home doing the shows from there. What else did we learn, Maura?
Lots of distractions.
We learned that people are concerned for Bob right now.
Bob, I was thinking about you earlier, just knowing how much of a germaphobe you are, and I was wondering, are you crippled with fear, or are you already on such high alert as it is that this is just business as usual for Bob Stilton?
It's another day in the life, Brady. People are just now learning what it is to be me, and it's true, though. It is really not a big difference in the way I go about my daily business. I'm washing my hands more. And I think it's more that people are getting a little peek behind the curtain of what it is to be me. It's not a big
Bob should do like an instructional video, Bob Stilton, for the public health.
Proper use of bleach wipes.
Yeah. Challenged. Yeah. What else did we learn, Maura?
That's all we learned.
All right. That's all the learning for the day. We got through it. Day one, a few bumps here and there. We'll get this thing streamlined in no time. We appreciate everybody hanging out with us. Thanks to our guests, John Clayton, Brady Henderson, and John Paul Morosi, for joining us on the program. If you missed any of today's show, or any day for that matter, just head to 710sports.com, click that podcast button, then just click on our picture. It's right there waiting for you at your convenience. We're going to be back with you tomorrow right here with Bob, Dave, and more on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Man, Wyman is my dude.